It's Thursday, May 9th, 2024, from Pete Fish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. A certain Stormy Daniels, which is to say Stephanie Clifford, which is to say, as the AP does, porn actor Stormy Daniels. I don't know if she would enjoy that designation. She testified, concluded her testimony, concluded cross-examination from the attorneys of President Donald Trump. And the media took great, shall we say, interest, if not glee, in Stormy Daniels' testimony. I do not know what probative value that there was in the testimony. I don't know what was actually gleaned that the jury could work with. A lot of embarrassing or seemingly embarrassing things. A lot of questions were raised that were objected to that the jury didn't even get to hear. I actually searched out what some of these objectionable questions are, but all the major news organizations refused to tell me. The source I defer to on the importance of these hearings is the Lawfare podcast, where my friend Benjamin Wittes, who's been on the show before, he said that he didn't think that the Stormy Daniels testimony really did much. In fact, he thought that it might have hurt the prosecution. And his point was there was nothing of value there. The cross-examination on behalf of the president at least offered a plausible suggestion that Stormy Daniels was out to get the president. She admitted as much, and that she's profited on her liaison with the president. $130,000 is a profit. Plus, she sells votive candles as a saint because she's been indicted on her website. The only thing maybe that the jury could have benefited from was a question asked by the prosecution. Did Donald Trump seem terribly upset that his wife would find out? No, he said, we even sleep in separate beds, to titters from the audience. But would we expect someone who is just engaged in an extramarital liaison to be knees knocking, quaking afterwards, please don't tell my wife? That's not very alpha male. That's not very sexy. That's not very billionaire. That's not very Donald Trump. Putting aside the idea that he would ever show weakness or the vulnerability of maybe I'm exposed, there's the question of, as a, I don't know, I'll diagnose him as a layman, as perhaps a sociopath, would this ever occur to him? But the legal argument is that therefore it shows that the hush money was paid not so that the wife wouldn't find out, but so that Donald Trump's political career would benefit. However, I see another interpretation, which is the hush money was paid out when Donald Trump was running for president because Stormy Daniels might have at that time properly perceived there was more of a market for information on Donald Trump having an affair. I don't think the host of The Celebrity Apprentice, specifically Donald Trump, absent a run for office, would generate that much interest if he had sex with a porn star a few years prior. Anyway, I don't know how much it really mattered. I do know that the media took huge interest in the fact that, and this has been reported before, that Daniel said that Donald Trump engaged in sex in the missionary position and did not last a long time. And I ask you this, what is the position? What is the, oh, did we have a warning? Here we go. What is the sexual position that a former president of the United States could have engaged with in his sexual congress with a porn star that would have reflected well on the office, the man, America, the legal system? If we found out that John F. Kennedy, oh, I won't name different positions, but do some of them cover him in more glory than others? Glory not being a euphemism for anything except the judgment of history. I do not know. Sex with a porn star, if you're the former president in any position, I think maybe we could name a couple that would raise eyebrows, but I think just the any position at all is equally or are equally shameful. Or if you're a supporter of the president, totally cool, bro. On the show today, I spiel about, let's do a 180 and let's talk about anti-balloon release ordinances in Florida and Louisiana. But first, Steve Fishman is the podcaster and former New York Magazine journalist behind Empire of Blood hit podcast. He is out with a new podcast, similar genre, New York, gritty, police, 1990s in this case. It is called The Burden, and I will talk with Steve Fishman about it next. Louis Garcella was a cigar-chomping, smooth-talking New York City detective. He worked during the most dangerous time in New York City history, and he was a star. His special skill, getting confessions from killers. Only it was revealed decades later that those confessions not just came at a price, but might have been either coerced or concocted. He is the central character, along with the men his testimony put behind jails. In the new podcast about this is The Burden. It's from Orbit Media. It is reported by Steve Fishman and Dax Devlin Ross. And Steve, who is also the producer of the series and has shepherded it through many years and a few incarnations, joins me now. Hello, Steve. Welcome back to The Gist.
Thank you, Mike. It's true. It is back, and it's nice to be back.
Yeah. The last time you were here was for your podcast, Empire on Blood, and this is your milieu, New York crime, when crime was really bad. Did you know of Scarsella before the New York Times even broke stories about him about, 10 years ago?
I did not. I kind of came into this story half a dozen years later. Which nonetheless was a long time ago. I look back and my first interview was, I think, 2019. I always plead COVID because we had a bit of a hiatus, but we've been at this a long time. So I can give you a little bit of a origin story if that...
Yeah, and the reason I asked, and so my listeners know, is I thought you might have, because your background, you work for New York Magazine, there's a character based on you in that Anna Delvey Netflix series, and you were always associated with gritty crime in New York, and you're a New York bar owner, as you explain in your series, and as you explain when I've been to your bar. But yes, I thought that maybe Scarsella was the sort of guy or sort of character that might have been on your radar already.
Scarsella was the sort of character. So the previous podcast, which you and I had spoken about on your show years ago, was Empire on Blood. So that took place in the Bronx. It was a deep dive into the criminal justice system there. My point of entry there was a wrongfully convicted guy who I followed for off and on 7 years. He eventually gets justice. But the interesting thing there for me was that I got to learn about that system through a guy seeking justice. And it always confounded me what the cops were thinking, what the investigators, what the district attorney was thinking. So what happens on the other side of that barrier? And then comes Scarsella, who's in the headlines. Disgraced Detective is the nickname he's given in the headlines. He's kind of tagged with this notion of being one rogue official, you know, really one bad apple spoiling the barrel. And to your point, Mike, I'd been doing crime long enough that I suspected that this guy was not masterminding the entire criminal justice system. So that became a point of entry. And now I felt like I had to get to Scarsella. And Scarsella was a no-comment guy for the last 10 years.
Yeah. He went from being an easy interview and someone who loved the publicity and was on Dr. Phil, and they made episodes about him on the TV show Top Cops. He cracked every case. He loved the spotlight. But then when the spotlight started to get a little more accusatory, he shied from it. And the series shows how you worked and worked and were a nudge and never took no for an answer. And then there's Scarsella in front of your microphone. Tell us a little bit about that process and how he came off to you.
I guess I like the stalking process. And I'm this side of the law. I'm the right side of the law, but still I am persistent. So I met Scarsella, you know, after calling, no response. One day my phone rings.
Is that Louie?
I don't want to talk over the phone. I think we should meet.
Okay.
I'll see you Thursday.
At the Parkview Diner, 2:30. Thanks, Louie.
You got it.
So I go to meet him in a Coney Island diner. Coney Island dear to him because this is a Brooklyn-born, Brooklyn-bred character who is the real deal. So we go to Coney Island. He talks for an hour, tells these stunning stories about hand-to-hand combat in the street. You know, Mike, like as a side note here, you said the days of bad crime. Well, for cops, it was good crime. I mean, yeah, they were great days to be cops, and Scarsella embraced it.
What did he say? Like, he caught 36 murders in a, what was his time period? And the guys before him would take a whole career to prosecute 36 murders?
He got 36 murders in 1 year.
Yeah.
So the city is really on the brink of failure, you know. It's overrun with crime. So I got to get to this guy, and he starts as, let's meet, let's talk again, and then begin this kind of series of, like, what I'll call tests. He invites me to his Russian bath, his favorite Russian bath. We go into the sauna, the ice plunge. He beats me with oak leaves. Okay, then he's president of the Polar Bear Club, so I'm obligated to jump into the freezing Atlantic. I follow him around for a number of expeditions to his, you know, scenes of the crime, which are the scenes of his glory. And finally, he says,
he went in the ice bath. He went in the ocean with me and
passed the test, right?
Passed the test.
And we bring him into the studio. And this guy who wouldn't talk talks to us for probably 35 hours.
Describe, what do you look like today?
I have to describe what I look like? Mm-hmm. That's very hard for a person to do. But I will. I will. Male, white, Caucasian. I don't know what the proper term is today, but I'm white, Italian, of course. I was born and raised in Brooklyn. I have about 22 tattoos. I'm in fairly decent shape for a 68-year-old man. And according to the New York Post, my hair is thinning. And out of all the things that they said about me, that hurt me the most.
You know, one of the things about this and about my journalism in general is that I think that people reveal themselves not only by being posed the hard questions when you sit down and confront them, but by talking and telling you their story. And I do think that's what happens with Scarsella. So just hearing him talk about how he did things is revelatory.
Right. Let's pause that for a second. Let's zoom out and let's talk about the actual innocence guys, the actual Innocence Project. And these were, well, you tell me, guys who are in prison because of their actions, but also because of Scarsella.
Sure. I mean, these are guys who are in prison. The group I'm focusing on is really in prison for murder. So a lot of them have life on the back of their sentence. They may never see light. They turn themselves into jailhouse lawyers, and they, by circumstance, meet at this one prison, Auburn, and they huddle, realize that some of them have been jailhouse lawyers for 20 years, and in particular, there are two of them who are really elite jailhouse lawyers, led by the kind of intellectual of the group who's Derek Hamilton, who told me, we spent a lot of time with Derek. He tells me, the law was my girlfriend. I had to love the law. It was my only way to freedom. So these guys meet. They decide to form essentially a law firm in prison. Now, you kind of, to set the scene, you have to kind of realize that these guys are probably the most oppressed in America. I mean, they're licking their own stamps. Some of them are writing their own appeals by hand and sending them off to the judges' chambers where they, you know, get lost sometimes. And actually, Derek tells this story about getting on the phone and impersonating a reporter for the Daily News, calling the judges' chambers just to give it some propulsion. You know, oh, judge, somebody's calling about this. What are we doing about this?
Right.
And these guys, there's this one moment where Derek looks at the motion of a guy named Shabaka Shakur, and they realize they both have Scarsella in their case. So these are core members of this prison law firm. They find another member of the prison law firm who also has Scarsella in their case. And they make this kind of band of brothers resolution. We got to get this guy. So the whole germination of the anti-Scarsella campaign is launched in this prison library. And these are the guys who decide Scarsella has a pattern and practice of misbehavior. And we can show it. They get in touch with this incredibly able, incredibly intrepid, somewhat over the top, brand new reporter at the New York Times, Frances Robles, who goes by the nickname Frenchie. Fantastic that she has like a film noir nickname. And they give her this information and she runs with it, kind of, I like to say fearlessly, because at one point she told me that she was warned that this story could be her undoing, physical undoing, because
yeah.
If you know, if she's trying to get wrongfully convicted out of prison, it means the rightful murderer is still on the street. And she retorts, if I have to die for this story, well, it's a good cause to die for.
Yeah. So the podcast episodes establish a character and we follow him, or Frenchie is the main character, I would say, in episode one. She's a scene setter. And then it goes back and forth. Some of the convicted men, one of Scarsella. Some of the convicted men, one of Scarsella. And it dawns on me at a time I knew about Scarsella, but also I think somewhere in my head was the name Louis Eppolito and Steve Caracappa, I think was his name. These are other New York City cops who are actually retired in Las Vegas and accused of being hitmen. I was like, wait a minute, those guys are in jail. Scarsella is accused of concocting false testimony. And I know that he's the disgraced New York City cop, but he's still talking to you. Why is he allowed to be free? Why was this not a criminal offense?
Well, this goes back and it's kind of interesting. You know, there's a lot of politics involved. And one of the things that we learned along the way is that Scarsella has, for most of this time, I would say 9 of the 10 years that he's been in the public spotlight as an infamous cop, he's been supported and backed by the district attorney, which has investigated cases. And I think this is a really important point, because Louis Scarsella had a 9th grade education, right? Effectively, socially promoted because he was a good ball player. 9th grade education, virtually no education as a detective. You're thrown in and basically told, figure out your job. So here's a guy who kind of is put forward at a kind of crucial electoral moment as the ringleader, the mastermind of the wrongful conviction. And when you look at it, it's very clear that he is part of a system and not the power behind that system. So the district attorney decides who to arrest, who to put on the witness stand, who to prosecute. And they do that based on re-interviewing witnesses and deciding if the evidence holds. So it's a specific example of this. Scarsella is accused of using one witness, a crack addicted young woman who lives in Crown Heights, which is like in that era that we're talking about, the 80s and 90s. It has 100 murders in one square mile. She claims, and she is said to have witnessed 6 murders. That's what comes forward eventually. Scarsella told us she witnessed 11 murders. In any case, she was a very talented witness. She was Scarsella's witness on cold cases and propelled his career, which, you know, to his credit, he's quite open and honest and talks about that. You know, suddenly he's solving all these cold cases. Well, it comes out years later that she was a witness in 6 cases, and it seems scandalous, right?
Yeah.
6, who, you know, she's like omniscient, omnipresent. Well, the DA goes in and reinvestigates this and basically concludes that it's plausible that this woman could have seen that many murders. She's hanging out in crack houses. She's a like small-time drug dealer. She's hanging out with the worst, right? So she can see them. And what's fascinating there is that her credibility, specifically on the stand, is challenged. And listen, we read transcripts. We got a hold of transcripts. And she's belligerent. She's rude. She's funny. She can't remember specific details about things like the year she was married. The year she...
Right,
the
year right. She's asked, why did you lie in the first trial? She's like, I was annoyed.
Yeah, I was pissed at the defense attorney. He was annoyed. I would have said anything, right? So she's completely without credit. There's very little doubt that she testified high at certain points. But the district attorney reinvestigates like 7 cases and comes out and says, you know, the prosecution knew who Teresa Gomez was. Everybody knew who she was. It was completely up to the district attorney's office to decide whether to put her on the stand or not. So they actually absolve. I mean, they basically say Scarcella was wrongfully convicted in the press. And I think that's a really salient point to hold in mind, because we end up having some visibility on these confidential reports, or the confidential parts of reports on that are done by the Conviction Review Unit, which is part of the district attorney's office, which 30 years later is reexamining a lot of these cases. So they say,
I get it. The cop's trying to get convictions. He has to check in with the district attorney. If they say this method doesn't fly, he'll change his method. They approve the method. He's going to keep using this particular method, and it's among his methods, but he's going to keep using it because it's an approved method to get convictions.
Absolutely. It's approved, it's vetted, and it's adopted. I mean, if you want to talk about Scarcella as a bad apple, well, the DA weaponizes him, you know? And listen, I will say, Scarcella did put a lot of bad guys in jail. I think what we reveal is that there's a kind of a consistent flaw, weakness that is exploited. First of all, 80s, 90s, 2,200 murders a year.
Yeah.
Juries just want these guys off the street, right?
Right.
They believe in the cops. It's actually...
And the DA's office does too. I mean, now in the age of 300, okay, maybe 400 murders in New York, you've got to think, and there's some evidence that district attorneys are discerning. They're like, no, let's only get the actual person who did the actual crime and put this person in jail. Back then... there were so many more cases. There weren't more resources to deal with the cases. There was the idea that, all right, I think he might have done this one. We definitely know he did this other one, or we definitely think he did this other one. So we'll get him for this one, but he really did the other one. It all evens out in the end. We took a murderer off the streets. That was going on then, too.
Absolutely. And, you know, so a prosecutor went up and said, this guy did it. He's a bad dude. And you know, let's get him off the streets. And I think the juries were obviously very willing to believe, in the face of hundreds and thousands of murders a year, that we would be better off without these people on the streets. And, you know, send them to prison, let God sort it out. You know, it's interesting. But we went back and looked at TV talk shows from that era. And you find the most liberal pundits. I mean, Joel Klein and Bob Herbert, an African-American man, they're on TV saying, we need more prisons. We need to send these people away. So it was
a time when... Well, the 1994 Crime Act was supported by the Congressional Black Caucus, and mostly from urban districts who were demanding just that, more prisons, stronger sentences, more cops.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that the black communities, especially in New York, were the most victimized by high crime.
Yes.
So there was a sense, and I think the first claim and really complaint of the black communities is, we're not getting enough policing. They don't care about us, right? So Dinkins is elected, and then he comes in as a social reformer. This is the late 80s.
Yeah, for about a week and a half.
That's right. And then there's that famous New York Post headline, Dave, do something. And what he does is he hires 1,000 new cops. And he says, I am willing to do whatever it takes to make the streets safe by day and by night. And the cops are sent in with a mission, take back the city. And people like Scarcella embrace that mission. Don't forget, they're the good guys. They're the guys who are going to make this world safe for, you know, your sushi bars and your dog runs.
Right. You and Dax are co-hosts of the show. And the dynamic there, and it benefits the audience, is you're a white guy from an older generation. And he's, how old is Dax? He's black. He's 40?
Mid-40s.
Yeah, okay. So he's of a younger generation, and how it plays out is you're explaining the milieu of the time. Dax is a smart guy. He's been on the show. He understands criminal justice. How much of that was just to be an audience surrogate, and how much of that was him not understanding, but really needing to be oriented and put into what the actual facts on the ground and mood of the time was?
Well, you're right. Listen, we did that really deliberately because I'm not only the age I am, but you know, a white guy living in a story, in a narrative that is about justice, and justice is about race. So it became very important to have somebody who could reflect on the situation from a different point of view. And Dax is extremely intelligent. I'd call him intellectual, and a black man of real discernment, who is also an investigative reporter and has won some awards for that. And then what was important to the story is we started, you know, despite the obvious differences that I laid out, with different biographies and relationships to the police. So before the bar that I've run now, I don't know if you were my previous bar, Mike, but
I heard it was, tell.
Yes, it was Irv's. It was on a very violent, dead end in Lefferts Gardens, and I brought Scarsella there one day, one afternoon, and we walked out. Look, he looked at the street. I said, I wanted a detective's appraisal, and he saw some guys playing dice in the afternoon and drinking, and, you know, some low-level drug dealing, and he says, nothing good can happen here. This is like atomic energy. You got big, as he would say, in Italian, cayunes, right? And you know, like, sure enough, a year later, there's a murder at my bar.
Okay, we're fading out here. You got a lot. There's a whole podcast out there if you want to know everything about The Burden by just listening to The Burden. But if you're a Pesca Plus subscriber, you will get to hear the rest of our conversation, including Steve Fishman's most recent interactions with Louis Scarsella and what he thinks about The Burden. Pesca Plus subscribers get special extended cuts of interviews like this one, and so much, much more. The cost, minimal. The reward, great. Plus, you're supporting quality journalism, or whatever it is we do. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com and check it out. And now the spiel. Balloon meat. You may be wondering what Ron DeSantis has been up to since he dropped out of the presidential race and returned to Florida to govern. The answer is balloon meat. The state was the first in the nation to pass a ban on lab-grown meat. On the one hand, lab-grown meat is a little bit better for the environment. On the other hand, it's not that much better. It's not that good for humans. It's a highly processed food. And did you hear my interview with the documentarians who ate chicken meat from a facility that wound up actually getting some mouse DNA intermixed with the chicken? I don't know. Maybe in Florida, the mouse is everywhere anyway. But the other big, or at least notable to me, and interesting legislative achievement, which DeSantis is about to sign into law, is documented by WPLG Channel 10 Miami, who offered details when a bill was being debated in the State House.
The new bill, now waiting to be signed by Governor DeSantis, sponsored by Republican House Rep. Linda Cheney of St. Pete Beach.
Livestock has died. Turtles have died.
Democratic Representative Diane Hart of Tampa arguing enforcement could disproportionately affect groups who hold balloon release events as memorials and commemorations.
People in the black community that I know, that's what we do as a cultural thing.
Now, that objection you heard there at the end, the Tampa representatives who talked about cultural disproportionality, she didn't find many people much in agreement with that stance. The vote was 102-9. However, there are other locales where the seemingly obvious ban on balloon launches for environmental reasons did not pass. For the exact reason you just heard, that the black community would be hit hard. The Baton Rouge Metro Council considered such a measure. The community weighed in, first a veterinarian with some sobering and, I thought, hard to rebut examples.
People talk about Mardi Gras beads. Well, we throw Mardi Gras beads. Well, Mardi Gras beads, if you throw a Mardi Gras bead in a lake, it's going to sink into the muck at the bottom. It's not going to float on the surface of the water and look like a jellyfish that a turtle's going to eat.
But the very next speaker was Letitia Dorsey, and here's how she began.
I'm just going to get to the point. I understand what she said about the animals or whatever, but my balloon release is in honor of my baby girl. I lost my only daughter at the tender age of 5. Sorry.
She composed herself and continued that she released balloons to honor her daughter, Lakira. And she said she often looks up to the skies to remind her of her daughter.
I heard that you all voted to allow 10 balloons to be released. Guess what? My angel baby girl would be 10 this year. She died on June 4th, 2013. So I wanted to make June 4th, 2023, a day where I will do an angel balloon release in honor of my baby girl, LaKira. And so I hope that the council will take into consideration my grief and what I'm dealing with. You know, are animals more important than my baby girl? No, indeed. You know,
I mean, what do you do? What do you do if you're on the city council and you hear that testimony? The bill's sponsor, Laura Adams, spoke soon thereafter, and she reached out to Letitia Dorsey. And the sponsor of the bill, Adams, was almost crying when she said, "I'd love to plant a tree for your beautiful daughter." But that sentiment was overwhelmed by the rhetorical case put forth by council member Cleve Dunn.
And so what I'm trying to tell you right now is to paint the picture of a cultural bias. So it's okay because I want to have fun, drink my beer, get wasted, play Mardi Gras beads that I'm never going to use again in life. I just catch them on a Saturday and throw them in the trash on a Monday because it's something to do in South Louisiana. But it's not okay for another culture in South Louisiana to continue to do the things that we do to represent our loved ones in a memorial state.
I don't actually know how I would have voted. The vote there in Baton Rouge, in the East Baton Rouge Paris, the vote went down 4-6, almost entirely on racial, though not entirely on party lines. Balloons are certainly fun to see float away, but really, they're just time-delayed litter, and they do get tangled in power lines, and they do wind up in the mouths and snouts of fauna. But yes, so do Mardi Gras beads, the sacrosanct in South Louisiana Mardi Gras bead. I heard one statistic that explained, almost in passing, why the balloon releases were so important to Baton Rouge, specifically the Black community.
Last year, more than 130 homicides happened in East Baton Rouge Parish, which means more balloons being released than you can count.
Jessica Knox of the local Fox and NBC co-affiliate. And I looked it up. East Baton Rouge Parish has about 500,000 people, and the demographics are 47% white and 47% Black. According to the BRPD chief Murphy Paul, Black victims accounted for 98% of all murder victims there. So maybe the issue isn't cultural sensitivity per se, but cultural safety. Or maybe this is a better way to put it. We, meaning not just Baton Rouge, but all of America, where the murder rate for Black people eclipses the national average. The cultural insensitivity is not being able to stanch the flow of murders, which necessitate a balloon release. Across America, tens of thousands of mourners, not thinking of the second or third order effects of what turtle or stork winds up getting a balloon or the string in its beak or bill. They're just grieving and doing what they can to look up to the heavens without too much capacity to consider all that happens next. And that's it for the show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads the division of special projects here at Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/The Gist. Doom Peru, G Peru, Do Peru. Thank you for listening.